This podcast is brought to you by ARC Facilities, providing instant mobile access to facility information for on-the-go teams. To learn more about our smart building technology, visit arcfacilities.com. And now, welcome to the Facility Voices Podcast with your host, David Trask.
Hi, I'm David Trask from ARC Facilities, and this is Facility Voices, the podcast that brings you real-world FM experiences from the front lines in the field. My guest today is Scott Mason. He's the Executive Director of Business Development at DNV Healthcare. Scott, welcome.
Hey, welcome, Dave. Thanks for inviting me. Look forward to our conversation.
Absolutely. So, Scott, you know, tell us a little bit about you and your background.
It's a circuitous route to where I'm at. So I guess if you go in the Wayback Machine, I was electronics tech in the Navy, right? So I was always electronics. Yep, thank you. Always a nerd in the electronics side. I got out and I went to work for one of the big life safety companies, the one with the big red S that Tyco and now Johnson Controls owns. So I started in the life safety industry straight out of the Navy. That's back in the day when fire alarms were relays and just starting to be first analog and then digital addressable devices. So right out of the Navy, I was in the life safety industry. I stayed in that industry up until about 2017. And I merged into, I was at a life safety company and I started a healthcare division because of a passion and some gaps of what I saw in healthcare. With the techs that were performing kitchen system inspections were the same ones at a Chinese restaurant were going over to the hospital to do the same inspection. But the requirements, albeit code-wise, were the same. The way that we're approached in documentation was vastly different. So I stood that up within inside that company, and then a compliance organization that did mock surveys hired me. Those that know, like Brad Keyes, if they know that name, he's like the life safety guy. He was the precursor to my good friend Josh Brackett. So I won't say the life safety guy, but
we all love Josh Brackett.
That's right. Well, that's how I met Josh. Actually, I met him doing some work for him when he was at Baptist Health in Little Rock. So we did all kinds of work in that arena, and that's how I ended up becoming familiar with DNV. So I read an article that the then president of DNV wrote about their approach to accreditation, which is totally different from the other accrediting organizations. And I said, why doesn't all organizations follow this pathway? Because it makes sense. And I always say, if the airline industry was held to the same standard as healthcare, which is less, in my opinion, they'd be out of business, right? And people look at me and say, what, why? And why do you say that? And I said, well, if you have 390 admin discharges a day, right? Which is 390 domestic flights a year. If you had 390 admin discharges or patients, which it's only 1/10 of that, right? It's 39 million. The airline industry has 155 deaths per year, which we already think is high. Healthcare at 39 million patients, you know, conservatively is north of 100,000 and probably closer to 250,000 deaths a year based on a number of different variables, but hospital acquired infections, wrong procedures, those kind of things. So my mentality was, if we are going to fix healthcare, which you've been around it enough, right? And in depth, most people's why is, I got into this to fix healthcare. It's the same for me. I got in this to fix healthcare. In my opinion, what we do and how we do it is important, but the why is what's in front, right? We all at DNV got into healthcare to change not only the accreditation process, but healthcare in general. How we do that, we have our own standards, right? We have NIHO, which is akin to the ECs and EPs of the world, but they are what I would say more closely aligned to CMS's COPs, conditions of participation. But we use ISO 9001 as a quality management system guideline, where our systems can choose to be, we'd like them to be 9001 certified. at the end of their three-year cycle, triennial cycle. So it is much more of a continuous improvement mechanism. Their standards should be set up to meet the COPs, and then we measure them to their standards versus having a standard that I press upon everybody regardless of their site. So that's the short answer to how I got here and a little bit of what we do. I took a detour for a number of years in asset management. That's how you and I met. And the company that I worked for, we developed a strategic asset management and capital planning tool, shameless plug, called Origin. It's a great product. And it allowed me to get in depth in the understanding, right, of facilities, not just facility management, but I'll call it asset lifecycle management, and to really start to dig down into the problem statements that they have. You know, 40 to 50% of all of a system, regardless of vertical. So you have multiple verticals, right? I see you, you know, view from an airplane on LinkedIn, and you know, it's going to some higher ed or educational facility or manufacturing or healthcare. And it's always the same. When we got in, regardless of vertical, we found 40 to 50% of all assets were in a deferred state. So it means they're past their useful life. Does it mean they're bad? No. It just means you're acquiring risk every day that it's running. So when you start to look at other forces, right? If you're doing a SWOT analysis on your department, you're looking at some of the things that are threats. Well, you have a finite budget, which in healthcare isn't growing, and yet there's a sustainability pressure being put on these organizations as well to acquire some goal, whether it's a zero carbon footprint or an Energy Star rating or something. Well, those things don't happen magically without money and without a strategy. So that is a lot of where I spent the last 5 years of my life prior to coming to DNV, was working with clients and how to best approach that and how to achieve that, and doing it through a risk-based system. So, you know, that's a little bit of how I got here.
Well, and I appreciate you sharing that, you know, and it's funny how everybody's journey is different. Everybody's path to where they are today is always different. And, you know, you started out in life safety and then compliance, and then merged strategic asset management into that, and now accreditation. And, you know, healthcare has obviously got such complex systems, and it's always a moving target. I love the stat that you shared, because I think that a lot of organizations can relate to 40 to 50% of their assets are in that past their useful life, past their scheduled time to die, so to speak, you know, and I see that. And as you mentioned, when I travel, I'm documenting where all this stuff is and field verifying what's out there. And I think that's part of the conversations that I hear, and I'm sure you have the same ones. They don't know what they don't know. They don't know what all is out there, because things change. It's a moving target all the time. And it's compounded in healthcare because they're open 24/7. It's constantly moving. And, you know, I talked to one FM the other day down in Texas, and he said, "Dave, listen, we do 300 work orders a day, 300. And he said, it's a constant moving target. And they're not all hot cold calls. You know, they're stuff breaks. You know, it's equipment, it's bedding, it's all the other stuff that, you know, somebody did a work order at 8 o'clock this morning, or maybe it was at midnight. You know, you don't see that in other verticals per se. But in healthcare, that's just on the daily. That's, you know, Tuesday, you know. So tell me how you apply your experience in life safety and compliance to healthcare.
Great question. You know, when I look at and get to work with our clients, right, there's some blocking and tackling. Like, I'm an old football coach. If I could do anything and get paid well for it, I would love to coach high school football. That's what I'd like to do. But, you know, my son's 36, so those days are a little past us. So when we start to look at, you know, for me, when I look at it holistically, right, life safety led into I guess Jonathan Flannery, Matt Steen, and Mark Mokel, right? I've done a presentation over the last few years at ASHI. They call it the buckets, right? I don't know if you've seen that.
Yeah.
So you've got your compliance bucket, which everybody, theoretically, everybody has to comply to, right? Those are the thou shalts. You must do these things. Regardless of who your accrediting organization is, they are code compliance required items. So those are your fire alarm inspections, generator, fire pump, those kind of things. So that bucket of dollars is pretty much untouchable, as I'll say it. Then you have all the things you just talked about, right? The break fix bucket, right? Those are the reactive maintenance. And that is everything from, hey, come hang a picture on the wall in the CEO's office to, you know, I've got a major breakdown and we need to get it repaired. And then you've got preventative maintenance. Well, what ends up happening is preventative maintenance becomes the place where the fuzzy math starts to being applied, right? Even though according to CMS, you're required to do all preventive maintenance in a healthcare facility, 100% of manufacturer's requirement maintenance, or have a risk-based alternate equipment maintenance program. One of those two. Neither one are easy to get to. So I'll say it that way. A lot of places will say, well, we do all our PMs. Your equipment will tell you a different story.
Well, and you heard what I said earlier, 300 work orders a day.
Right. Something's got to give.
Something's got to give.
If you look at ASHI's FTE thing, an account, right, they look at it, one FTE for every 31,000 square feet. Some are better, some are less, but that's about their average. So you have got a large amount of real estate to cover per FTE for all the systems and things that they have to cover. Because right. It's not just maintaining equipment. It's hazardous materials, life safety, emergency management, safety, security. I mean, go right down the list. Biomed. I mean, they have a tentacle into everything.
They do.
And quite honestly, they're a jack of all trades, masters of none. And some of them have expertise, but they count on vendors to really help them with those things, right? Your organization, and you in particular, you guys help them with asset inventories and locations. That is the baseline for us to do a capital plan. If you don't know your inventory, there's no point in doing your capital plan.
Well, and it's in many cases, it's garbage in, garbage out too. And, you know, it doesn't take long for it to get out of hand.
Right. And so how all these things merged for me was it just became a continual progression, right? Mark Mokel asked me, I came to work for FHI. And he's like, hey, do you want to help one organization or hundreds of organizations? And that, you know, for me, I'd like to help a number of organizations, hundreds of organizations, thousands if we're allowed. But that is how I got involved with ASHI. Josh Brackett said, we're doing some work together. And he's like, you really should come hang out with us on this team and volunteer. And that's how I got involved in ASHI and have made some of my best friends, quite honestly, not just peers, but some of the best people that I hang out with today were made through that relationship. So just been blessed. And that's...
Well, and it's a community. I'm a firm believer that it's a community. And, you know, one of the things that I think is unique about facilities management, about anybody who's in FM, is it's not a competition. You're not in competition with the hospital up the road. It's not like that. It's we all learn from each other. And I love that you've got that resource library of people to reach out to. And I'm the same way. I had people that reached out to me over the weekend and I said, aren't you unplugged? You know, it was a holiday weekend. But they had a problem. They had a question. Right. And just being able to and keep in mind, I couldn't help them with what they needed, but I knew somebody. So I connected that dot. And that's what I mean by there's not that kind of competition. It's, listen, we're all here trying not to reinvent the wheel. We just, right. You know, if somebody else has got it figured out, great. And more often than not, those people are more than willing to share.
Yeah, they have the same heart, right? You know, finding your tribe in life is part of that journey. But when the people that I tend most to surround myself with are the people that are giving others a hand up. They're not interested solely in what they're accomplishing, right? They have their job. I have a responsibility to DNV, but I also feel like I have a responsibility to the industry and to those people that I work with. And I think that is part of the bigger, you know, what Josh's wife, right, Lindsay, you know, she has legacy and empowerment. I'm sure that somewhere one of them have a tattoo that say legacy or empowerment.
I've had Lindsay on the podcast. She's phenomenal. Right. But she walks the walk.
Yeah, that she lives it, right? She lives legacy and empowerment. And Josh lives legacy and empowerment. I could go right down the list. Frank Ritaluso, Shay Rancorn. I mean, some of the people that I never would have met outside of being vulnerable, right? And being available and just wanting to move the needle in the industry. So
agreed. You know, and I think that's so important. You know, that's how, you know, you and I connected too, is it was organic, you know, and I think that's some of the strongest relationships. You know, I just had a phone call with Josh a couple of weeks ago about something completely unrelated, and just, I think the openness in the community to share that kind of information, because I think in facilities, I think it's really, and this is just my personal opinion, and it's probably not for everybody, but they legitimately care. They legitimately want to help. And you said that earlier. It's not an insincere fact that these people are trying and to help you not have to go through the hurdles that they have to go through.
That's right.
Jump through
That's
those hoops, right. You know, and again, reinventing that wheel, you know. You mentioned risk earlier. Tell me a sure. little bit about the risk and how that plays a role in strategic asset management, and, you know, share some examples of that.
Sure. And risk and understanding risk for me has been a journey. And quite honestly, it is with the advent and introduction of ESG, it is an ongoing study, I guess is how I'll say it. Because, you know, in its simplest terms, right, you've got the probability of failure and then the what are the circumstances, the things around failure, right? And those things make up a business risk score. So depending on how you score those was what the math would be. But basically, those are kind of the components that you would look at. And you can look at other things. Like we would look at reliability, right? Redundancy, those kind of things. The product that we had built actually talked to CMMSs. So it would tell you if you were getting corrective work orders or PMs, right? So PMs, good. Corrective work orders, bad in the basic sense, right? One is planned, one is reactive. Mm-hmm. And your goal is to have fewer reactive work orders. So from a risk standpoint, you don't risk an air handler in the atrium the same as the air handler in the OR.
Agreed.
Right? So you have to look at environmental, not just health, right? Is there a safety factor, patient risk factor in healthcare? It might be product quality in a manufacturing facility. It might not be a risk to human element, but then there's the risk to the bottom line, right? There's a business right. risk. And so as you look at risk, it can't be a very simple 1 + 1 = 2. It's really a much more complex thing than that. You know, I talked to you a little bit about Susan Greenman. I've shared with you on some of the notes, but she wrote a book. It's one of my favorite books. Sorry, I got it. It's Risk-Based Asset Criticality Assessment Handbook. It's expensive, I'm going to tell you. If you're not into investing in yourself, it is worth the money. I think it's $35. It's a small book, but it'll walk you through the thought process of creating your own risk analysis and your risk modeling. And you'll end up with, you know, your own business risk number or asset risk number. Mm-hmm. And why that's important is when you are quantifying and qualifying your dollars for asset replacement or investment, you want to do that by risk. You want to take the emotion out of it. You know, I feel like this thing has been giving me a problem. I feel like we should do this. I feel like I mean, that's usually the first three words of every quantifying statement is I feel like. Well, if you're a data-driven COO, CFO, CEO, you want the reason why we should replace it. And from a business standpoint, if you make a business case for it, like if this air handler goes down, yeah, we can get a replacement in a week that's temporary sitting in the parking lot, but we're not going to get it on the roof for a year. So you're going to have a rental for a year, additional maintenance, and you're going to lose that week of downtime. And then you still have to buy one and get it on the roof. So that $2 million that you were going to spend in a planned event now became $5, $6, $7 million in replacing it.
It's compounded, you know, and I think where a lot of FMs struggle, and I actually had another podcast recording I did with a gentleman at a hospital. He shared a couple of things that I thought were great insights. He said, know your audience. When you're going in there and you're going to sell your business case, developing that business case has to be surrounded by not just the impact on the facility, in his case, patients as well, the bottom line, of course. But equally, he said, it really came down to know the audience you're going to present that to in the first place. Nope. Spell it out in layman's terms. They are not facilities professionals. They don't know the first thing about facilities. But if you tell them it's going to impact ORs 1 through 4, and we're going to be down for a month, or like you said, it takes the dollar spend from a planned $2 million incident or replacement to a $5 million, and it still takes you a year to get that other unit. He said, you don't have to get as granular as, you know, that unit that's in the parking lot taking up 4 spaces for, right, for a year. But he said it would be if it's their spaces, you know, right, and I thought that was an interesting take. He said,
right,
put it in their terms, you know, it's going to impact your office, you know, or sure, it's going to impact your bottom line. But especially in healthcare, it's such patient focused. The impact on the patients, it's compounded because if the OR is down, that impacts them having to get the tests redone before they have that planned surgery or that unexpected surgery or whatever the case may be. It's not even a trickle down. It's an immediate impact.
No. And the other thing is when you start to do a risk analysis, right, what is your reputation? What is going on if you can't perform surgeries? Look, it's no secret right now that healthcare organizations are struggling. And one of the reasons are that for whatever reason, people have chosen not to come back to the hospital for procedures. So in the past where your breadbasket was elective procedures, right? If those are down, you've got an economic impact. If you compound that with an equipment failure or worse, right, something happens, that now starts to impact your reputation in the community. And we all know, right, it takes one oh my to offset 10 attaboys, and it takes a long time to get that back. So having that credibility in your market, what if you're in, there's a mid-sized city here in the Midwest, which I won't name, but there's basically two major health systems in it. And when one builds a hospital or a micro hospital or an emergency facility on the very kitty corner or somewhere right near there, their competitor is going to build one too, you know, and it's all who's prettier and servicing the client. So it's real fascinating, the market, but it is competitive. It is something that I think has to be addressed. You know, facilities is not a revenue generating cost center, right? They are cost to the business. The problem is nobody's really thinking about the life cycle costs. They're thinking about the first time, right? The day one costs or the first costs. So the discussions that I've had over the years start in planning and design, right? We've all heard the term value engineered. Facilities maintenance gets the downstream impact of most value engineering, right? It's substandard equipment. It's substandard engineering, right? Which disallows the hospital to make decisions down the road for the betterment of the hospital, for efficiencies, patient safety, and those things. So all those things come into play. And It's still a passion of mine. I still stay in contact with my old Brightly friends there because they are still trying to develop and drive a product, but it'll probably remain a passion of mine, just like life safety. So it's just the evolution of asset management and, quite honestly, the client journey.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I say this all the time. I learn from every one of these podcasts, and I learn from every call I have with even a prospective client, as well as our existing clients. You know, we learn every day. I ask this from a place of they don't know what they don't know. Okay. And let me preface what I'm about to ask by saying that is, what kind of exposure can an org expect when they don't consider risk as part of their overall business plan or their long-term goals?
The outcomes that we generally see, right? You have a highly reactive maintenance department, which means you have typically a higher degree of asset failure, which in our world today, we have less and less skilled trades. And of the skilled trades, there's a giant tribal knowledge drain, right, from the silver tsunami, guys like you and me. I'm not doing this for the next 60 years. I will if God tells me to, but
you'll go out kicking and screaming, though.
Well, he's got to give me the longevity to do that, right? I'm 60 this year, and all the things that we've acquired over the years is knowledge we want to pass down and apply, but that pool is very minimal, not just from a number, but from a depth, I guess, is how, or a curiosity is what I've said. You know, what are you generally curious? Do you subscribe to the five whys? I mean, get to the real why. Let's figure this out. And so when you adopt a strategy that is not what I would consider risk-based, you are, in fact, putting your organization at risk, partly because of financial, but more so, right, in the industry that you and I, that I predominantly live in, and you spend a lot of time in, is in healthcare. If I make a mistake in a manufacturing facility, it could cost some money. Defects, machine might break. If I make a mistake in healthcare, it could cost somebody their life. And it sounds melodramatic until it's you. In 2021, I had COVID extremely bad, like on death's doorstep COVID, immediately followed by triple bypass surgery. So that was a great year. And the hospital I was in had amazing care. And I'll say it's the Ann Arbor VA. I'll give them a shout out. Yeah. You know, but I did have a challenge. My thermostat was broke in my room. And so it would either be 85 or 55. And so the nurses, right? The nurses would call down and say, hey, it's too hot. And they would basically switch it to cooling. And then 2 hours later, I'd be an icicle. And then they'd call and say, it's too cold. And they'd switch it, you know. And I just finally said, quit calling them. Leave it cold and bring me warm blankets, because it was over a holiday weekend and it was a skeleton crew and nobody's coming up to fix that, right? They're going to sit at a computer and tap it out of their BAS. So
that's right.
At least I knew that. But on the other side was, why do they have those problems that people can't address, and what are they? It was a new BAS. You know, I learned all the things that I probably shouldn't know as a patient, but because inquiring minds want to know, everybody will share stuff with you.
Sure.
But did it get resolved? Absolutely. But you have to look at it from a risk-based, like in that environment, you don't want too much humidity where you can cause other things. I was just trying to get my body to stabilize from massive surgery. And I gave the clinical direction that made me comfortable. And fortunately, my nurse was smart enough to advise me otherwise if she thought it. But I mean, but it's interesting the impact that we have. I mean, because people don't realize, you know, temperature, humidity, all those things play a role in the recovery and health of patients and surgeries. If it's too dry, you could have a risk of fire in an OR. People are like, a fire in an OR? Well, yes, you have alcohol and static electricity. Two bad things together. So, you know, on the other hand, if you have too much humidity, you could have infection because it promotes bacterial growth. So it's all those things that a good facility team has to deal with that the average person doesn't even consider. They think it's like their car. They get in and turn it on and they expect it to work. So risk, to me, is part of that fundamental process that takes deviation or any of those things out of a problem statement as much as possible. So that is why I think risk analysis, failure mode analysis, all those things, all those Six Sigma things that people skip over on LinkedIn that I love, those are things that resonate with me because I get why we do them.
So Scott, in closing, give me a few things that you think an organization should consider when really looking at risk within their organization.
It's a top-down exercise, first of all. It's not facilities trying to solve the problem in a vacuum. And when I say that is your risk management needs to be congruent with your mission, vision, and values of your organization. So first, you need to align those. So if you, one of your values is that we're going to be a zero carbon footprint by 2035. Well, guess what? One of your risk factors need to be. That needs to be in there because that determines your trajectory. If zero patient harm, right, is one of your thing, or a 50% decrease in hospital acquired infections, or 25% decrease in morbidity rates, or whatever those are, nobody likes to broadcast those, but internally, those can be the metrics that you're guiding. And then set up your risk based on that, which will help you define your process in the future and your standard operating procedures. So once those are all in line, some might call that a quality management system, but I'm just saying that is actually how you utilize risk to decrease the things you want to decrease and increase the things you want to increase, right? HCAHPS scores. We all want better HCAHPS scores in healthcare. Well, that doesn't happen by accident. That needs to be done through a risk analysis and a process to increase that. And then with a process, you have to measure it and be able to look at continuous improvement.
Scott, I really appreciate your insights today. And for everyone, look forward to catching you on the next episode of Facility Voices. Thank you.
David, thank you. I appreciate your time. Take care.
You too.
Thanks for tuning into Facility Voices, a podcast that explores the big issues and challenges facing the facility management industry today. We welcome your feedback, ideas, and suggestions for topics and guests. Send an email to communications@arcfacilities.com or reach out to our host, David Trask, on LinkedIn. Facility Voices is brought to you by ARC Facilities.